straight up, because I'm in Melbourne, and when I come to Melbourne, I do have to be honest about these things. For nearly 50 years, I'm afraid I am guilty of being a Hawthorn supporter. So I know, and I just want to mention that straight up now, because anyone who has to leave, you may as well do it now, because I'd hate to deceive you and tell you at the end. But that's the way it is. We won't mention yesterday's score that we won. Oh, did I say that? anyway, so moving on, I just had to confess that I haven't yet repented, but you know, maybe one day. So I'm Dr. Mark Brunacci. I'm a GP from Sydney, and I live in the Hawkesbury in Sydney, which is the northwest area. I've just got to get used to my two-handed approach here, so I'm going to click this one here, that's it. That's my mob. That's my extraordinary wife. Yeah, and, we laugh too. I was a GP in Sydney. Most of my work now is actually in hospitals. I do what's called surgical assisting, which is helping orthopedic surgeons do their thing. When you have an operation, apart from all the other people, the surgical team is the surgeon. And you need basically one brain and four hands to do operations. I supply two hands, and the surgeon supplies all the rest. So it's a good job. And I also look after people in nursing homes, so I still do some GP work when I can. Now, so I have seven children. Those of you who are quick, of course, will realise that there's nine in that picture, but there's actually a wife and a fiancé in there as well. So we're moving on into that phase, which is very exciting. But today I'm here not as a doctor. I essentially am. I'm here not as a preacher, certainly. I'm here as a doctor. I'm here as a science-trained person, because I want to share with you why I trust the Bible. That wasn't supposed to happen. Here we go. Sorry. There we go. I don't probably see it. There we go. Sorry, my screen's not behaving the way it should, but it will in a minute. There are many scientists like myself, many with PhDs, who work with Creation Ministries International, and those that don't work with us, but scientists around the world, who would want you to, like me, to believe that the Bible is trustworthy as a true account, both historically and scientifically, of the world's history. Now, Creation Ministries has more scientists working for it around the world than any other Christian ministry. So this is the message. Andrew gave a lovely introduction to some of this, a little mention of a couple of things that that I want to talk about. And also thank you, Andrew, also for honouring the helpers, because the people that help us as speakers, seriously, we could not, it would be absolutely impossible to do what we do without those people that give up their time and effort to do all those things that are needed to make a ministry like this work. So thank you, Andrew, for mentioning them too. So, you know, basically, I'm going to be here to encourage you to think that the Bible is true history. It's written, for all that it is, it's also a history book, and it gives us a true account of our origins, and that reading the Bible plainly without putting any twists or turns in it, it does appear to tell us pretty clearly that we were made intentionally by our loving Creator God over a period of 6 24-hour days, approximately 6,000 to 7,000 years ago. And that's it. Now we're going to talk about, you know, alternative stories and where the two, you know, how the two interact. But that's basically what we're saying. And the science, I can tell you without, unfortunately, having long enough to give you all the details, I could be here all day, is overwhelmingly in favour of that reading of the Bible. And that's very important. But we'll start at the beginning, so it's a good place to start. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and God did this by just speaking things into existence. And these early verses and chapters of Genesis lay down a foundation from which the gospel message will later spring. And in those early verses and chapters, we hear a number of important, very fundamental historical and theological truths. And without those, the gospel just doesn't really stand out. So we need to understand who we are and where we've come from, because those are very, very important questions. The questions of who we are and where we come from are probably the things that most in our lives affect how we look at ourselves, how we see ourselves, and how we see our place in the world. consider our origins, there are two completely contrasting stories. On the one hand, you know, we have the biblical one, where we have a loving and powerful creator that brings the world into being just through the power of his word, and does so, and in doing so, of course, we are then made in his image as the pinnacle of that creation. And the reason that we exist, according to the Bible, is because we are to be in relationship with our Creator God. That's why we exist. It's all about relationship. And really, the Bible, you know, I mentioned this, is, amongst other things, a history book. All history books have agendas. Every history book has an angle. The Bible, as a history book, is the history of the relationship between God and man. It's a history book from God's perspective. And so it has a lot to tell us about who we are and where we've come from, obviously. And right there at the beginning, it's all laid out. Now, the alternative is that we're just chance products of a purposeless and indifferent universe, which somehow makes itself. Now, to my mind, you can only have one of those two. You can't have them both. But regardless of that, because they're so different, but despite that, over many years, a lot of well-meaning Christians have attempted to try and fit the two together because of the power of the forces that, you know, try and convince us of this alternative story. Well, maybe they can kind of live together, and you know, so we can get the millions of years that evolution needs into the Bible somehow. And these are some examples of the kinds of ideas that arise from that. Now, I myself grew up in a Catholic home. And I had a Catholic education, and I grew up as a quite comfortable theistic evolutionist. Now, theistic evolution, which is possibly the most common position, that if you're not a biblical creationist, so to speak, theistic evolution is where, well, yes, God creates everything, of course, but he does it using evolution. So the two can sort of come together. And I grew up with that. That's how I was taught at school. I had no issues with that particularly. Unfortunately, though, that didn't stand up to scrutiny when I got to university, because the very first question I was ever asked about the Bible and how it can't possibly be true, I had no idea on how to answer that. And so my faith was severely tested, and in fact, I stopped going to church, didn't do so for some years until God, in his providence and grace, led some friends into my path that took me back to church, and I made the great divide and ended up in a Protestant church. And eventually found my way to a Baptist church, actually, in the northwest of Sydney, where I then stayed for over 20 years. And it was there that I started getting answers. And it was there that I met my wife. And at some point before we got married, she introduced this idea that, hey, look, the Bible's actually history. Did you know that? And I said, you're kidding. What, people believe that? That's crazy. But she gave me information and some answers to questions that I hadn't understood. And it was very clear to me after a very short time that, well, hang on, we're onto something here. And it didn't take me long to be convinced that the Bible is actually a trustworthy document of history. So this is an important thing that we get this right, because, you know, it happened to me. I know this is how things can go wrong. Because the thing with all of these ideas is that they all suffer one major problem, and that's that God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now, very good in the Hebrew essentially means perfect. So, looking back at this, this is the perfect creation built on a foundation of all this horrible death and suffering and disease, and there's all sorts of cancer and all the fossils have been found with all the diseases that we currently know. So, is this the kind of thing that you know would lead, if I was to try and imagine God's mind, that I'd be, you know, find that would be, you know, very good? I'm not sure. So, looking at us from a humanist point of view, meaning a humanist point of view means that there's no God and that evolution explains everything. Our life doesn't have a lot of meaning or purpose. And here are some quotes from famous scientists and philosophers about, you know, who is man? What is man really? So Bertrand Russell says we're just a curious accident in a backwater. Peter Atkins from Oxford says we're just a bit of slime on the planet. There's a lot of people that feel that the Earth would be far better off without humans, which from an evolutionary point of view probably makes sense, but it's not certainly a biblical point of view. Stephen Jay Gould from Harvard says very poetically, we're a fortuitous cosmic afterthought, a tiny little twig on the enormously arborescent bush of life. That all sounds lovely, break it down, basically it means we're just a little speck of insignificant nothing in a very vast universe that doesn't care, which Richard Dawkins is happy to explain to us much more bluntly. He says we live in a universe which has no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. We're just an accident of nature, we just live, we die, and that's all there is. That's life, which is a pretty sad kind of way of seeing the world. So, you know, that's... That kind of thinking would clearly affect how you view, as I say, how you view the world, how you view yourself. It would have a very strong effect on how you look at things like abortion or euthanasia, because the value of life is very much diminished. It's completely undermined by that kind of thinking. You know, we see an epidemic ever growing of suicide. Well, I mean, if things are going wrong in that kind of, sorry, I'll just go back to that, in this kind of world where we, you know, we live like that, what's the point of trying? There's nowhere to go for help, there's nowhere to go for hope. As opposed to the biblical view where there is always somewhere to go for help and there is always hope, and we have a promise that it isn't always going to be like that, that everything will be okay in the end. And that's that's how we can carry on. Here we go. So evolution basically attempts to destroy the gospel message. This is a quote from an American atheist called Frank Zindler, and he is quite comfortable in dismissing the historicity of Genesis. It's not relevant as far as he's concerned. And so he says this. He says, the most devastating thing that biology did to Christianity was the discovery, and I'll put that in inverted commas in my notes, of biological evolution. Because biological evolution, by the way, wasn't a discovery, it was a thought. It's a thought bubble. It was a philosophical statement. It wasn't a scientific discovery, but we'll discuss that later. Now that we know, somehow, that Adam and Eve were never real people, the central myth of Christianity is destroyed. If there never was an Adam and Eve, then there was never an original sin. This is talking about Adam and Eve as historical people. If there never was an original sin, there is no need of salvation. If there is no need of salvation, then there is no need of a saviour. Which then leads us to the logical conclusion from an atheist point of view, or from an evolutionary point of view, I think that evolution is absolutely the death knell of Christianity, because if it were true, if evolution were true, then Jesus becomes irrelevant, because even though he may have been a real historical person, if in fact there is no God, which is what evolution tells us, who cares who Jesus is? It's irrelevant. So it's very, very important that we understand. suggest the institution's philosophy of education is secular humanism. This is that worldview where there's no God and evolution explains everything. Students are bombarded with this at every lecture as the basic assumption. This constant brainwashing destroys the faith of many Christians each year. Our surveys indicate that 80% of first-year students believe in a God who is there. And by the end of that first year, or by their second year, only 15% believe in God. So that's an extremely effective course in unlearning. And it just shows how fragile the faith of people can be, because if they're not prepared, if they haven't got answers to the questions that they're going to come across, then this is the sort of thing that happens. Ironically, of course, I went to university and went the other way. That's another story. But I was definitely an exception. And it wasn't because of university, it was because of people that God led me to. It doesn't happen at university, though. Initially, it starts earlier than that. We used to go mid-high school, you start to learn about evolution and stuff in science. And kids, you know, they want to understand things the way they really are. They're not interested in spin. They want to know the truth. And so they're trying to reconcile what they're being told about evolution in class, often with a direct attack on their faith. Some teachers, particularly at university, will you know, target the Christians. But they're being told stuff about evolution in science class, and they're being told other stuff at home or at church. And the two aren't coming together, and it's clear. And unless they're getting the answers at home and in church about what they're hearing in school, most kids will eventually come to the conclusion that the Bible can't be relied upon for truth, because they're being told what the truth is at school, and they're very likely to abandon their faith. So, you know, this slide shows a result of one of many surveys in America that shows that up to 70% of children brought up in Christian homes and in a church will leave the faith as soon as they're old enough to make the choice for themselves. These people describe Christianity as irrelevant and uninspiring and just the faith. I don't know how many of you have read the stuff of Jordan Peterson. He's very popular these days as a sort of psychologist sort of guy, and he talks about Christianity. He isn't a Christian, because when you investigate, you know, when you look into what he believes, he doesn't believe most of the basic tenets of our faith. And he said himself exactly the same thing. He left the faith as a child, and when asked why, he said, though, for the same reason that everybody does. And the same reason that everybody does is because they couldn't gel the two so can I do a sermon on the science of origins? They'll say, no, you can't. But he may know more than I do. But because we're scientists, we it gives us the authority to speak. But you certainly don't need to be in order to know this stuff. In fact, it's our desire that all of you can do this because it is quite within your reach. And the idea of creation ministries, therefore, is to supply you with all the information, the resources, the knowledge that you would need to have the confidence in your own faith that you can share that with others. Our job is to defend the scriptures from the very first verse. We do it by speaking, as I'm doing now, but more importantly, we do that, as you've heard, by we provide a lot of resources, and we do that with books and DVDs and magazines and online resources, and our aim is to encourage you in your faith, to equip you with information, and to empower you to share that with others. I don't like that word, but it seems to fit here, that it gives you that that strength to go and share. There's a picture of Creation Magazine, which is our best known publication. How many people here are already subscribers to Creation Magazine? Is there anyone here? There's a couple of hands going up. Okay, all right. Well, the good news, part of the good news today is that you've hopefully been or given a free copy of the magazine, something like books like that. Different, possibly not all the same edition, but all the same. And that's a gift from us, and not from us as a ministry. It's a gift from our supporters who feel that this is such an important resource that they have supplied the ability for us to just give these away to everyone that we speak to. It's our flagship publication. It's our number one witnessing tool, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. I'll come back to that. Now, Creation Ministries has a website. It's a massive website. I don't know how they can fit it all into one computer, but it all kind of gets in there somehow. There's over 12,000 articles on this now, and they cover all the different topics that we talk about. Anything to do with anything that relates to Genesis 1 to 11 in any way, put in a couple of key words like missing link or dark matter, just to mention a couple of recently mentioned topics, or the flood, anything which you like. Put it in there and you'll end up with a string of articles and videos and things that relate to that. Now, the problem I've always had, and I've argued with, is the website address is too complicated. It is just, who can remember that? It's just way too hard. But anyway, now I'm just going to give you a moment to think about that. Perhaps in that moment, is there anyone I can actually bring you a glass of water or something? I'm going to need that by the end. Thank you very much. So anyway, I'm going to test you, so I hope you've got that memorised. The only other thing I'll mention now before I go on with the talk is that we also have a free email newsletter called InfoBytes. Now, also on your seats, did you know that one of these was on your seats? Apart from the interesting little snippet of information that's on there, let me just tell you about InfoBytes. Oh, thank you very much. Now, InfoBytes is an email newsletter that is... I'll catch up with myself here. It's a way of keeping you, everyone, up to date with the latest news and views with relation to creation, evolution, and everything to do with what we talk about. A website's great, and we keep that up to date, but this is a bit more dynamic. For example, you know, if a major article came out about, you know, if the missing link has been found again, something about dark matter that, you know, rocks everybody, then within a few days we can put out an InfoBytes just to give a biblical perspective on that article, because what you read in headlines doesn't tell you all the story, and it's all in the detail. So, you know, we can give you a response to what appears to be devastating information that makes, you know, that undermines the biblical truth, but of course it never is actually that. So this is a way of getting information to you. Also, people write in and say, look, I've got a problem with this aspect of dinosaurs or the flood. And we might publish that question and give an answer, so you can sort of see the kind of questions people ask and how you might be able to answer it in a biblical fashion. And apart from that, it gives links to all sorts of interesting articles and videos to keep you informed. You also get a first time that you get your newsletter, you also get a free download of a thing don't spam you. It's only a few times a month, and it's just a way of keeping you in charge. Now, with this, what I'd like you to do now, if you would, I'd just like to share another one. It's great. Well, I'm truly hydrated now. On the back is an opportunity for you to sign up. There's a pen that hopefully came with your magazine, and I would strongly encourage you to sign up for our free email newsletter called InfoBytes. Obviously, we would need your name and okay, this is just a few ideas of some of the kind of articles you come. Okay, that's not what it looks like, but it's the same kind of form. Name and an email address. The postcode is so that if we have an event going on in Perth, we won't bother you about that. And we'll just keep things as relevant to you as possible. But I would encourage you to fill that in and pass those to the end of the row, one way or the other, and one of my helpers will come and click that in a moment. It's free, it's an email, you can always unsubscribe if you want. I strongly suggest you sign up because you will find it really interesting, and it's far better than, you know, Twitter feed or your Facebook notifications in your inbox. This would be something actually worthwhile. So please sign up. I promise you won't be disappointed. So I've just popped that one up because that's an oldie but a goodie. And I'll just let that joke roll. There's no drum roll. Okay. Now, Adam Goods, this is just an example of the kind of thing you would get in for Bytes. This is back a few years, but most of you would recall that Adam Goods was called an ape by a young girl at a football game. And that was a big thing, huge furore. I mean, it was big news. Well, obviously, he was in a Sydney player, so it was big news in Sydney, but I'm sure it was big news down here as well. And then he became Australian of the Year, and there's all this talk about racism. Now, of course, from a biblical perspective, there's a thing as racism, because we are all one race. We're all descended from the same people, so how can there be racism? It's a non-subject, but that's not the way that the world understands race. And certainly, with all the furore and all the anger, nowhere in the media actually explained to you why it was a problem to call Adam Goods an ape. I mean, I could call Andrew a monkey, and that would be impolite, perhaps funny, but it's not racist. But if I'm calling Adam Goods an ape, then it is. So what's the difference? Some of you would know, but it was never explained that if you had InfoBytes, then within a few days you would have understood exactly what the implication was, because to call Adam Goods an ape implies something about evolutionary theory. Because until not that long ago, it was generally believed that the darker your skin was, the less evolved you were, because you were nearer to our ape ancestors. And that's a nonsense statement, because we know from genetics that that's just not true. And so educated people know that. But from a biblical perspective, it's a non-event because we are all one race. So it's just one of those things that you know, an understanding of the Bible and where the truth lies in things can make a big difference. So, you know, InfoBytes would have told you about that. So, does truth matter? Of course it does, because we need to know the real history of the world, because that's fundamentally knowing who we are and who God the Father is and who Jesus was and why he did what he did in his time on earth, as recorded in the Gospels. Because if there was no historical Adam, then, you know, when Paul says that Jesus is the last Adam to remove the curse of the first Adam, if the first Adam didn't exist, there's a problem. Why did Jesus have to die for someone who wasn't real? That's only one example of you know, why biblical understanding is important, because it's hard to explain. understand that. Well, hang on, I've got an idea of how that might work. Let's test that out. Let's do some experiments, and I'll try another experiment, and then I'll get another scientist to do some experiments, and we'll just refine this idea until it seems to explain what we're seeing. This is how science works, and it's how we end up with laptops that work and screens that are almost big enough. All that sort of stuff comes from this, what we call operational science. And this form of science was actually developed initially back in the Enlightenment by Bible-believing Christian scientists. And here's just a list of them, and there were more. These are the fathers of science, the fathers of chemistry and physics and astronomy and all these things. They all believed the Bible. Bacon, Galileo, Locke, Kepler, Isaac Newton, he was a pretty decent scientist. These people all believed in the Bible and in a creator God. And so they felt that the world could be understood because it was a world of order because God had made it. And those scientists that didn't believe in God didn't feel that it was worth studying the sciences in the way that these people, because they felt the world was chaos and random. And what was the point? But these guys, had an insight into how God did things, and they wanted to understand more about it. Kepler, in fact, said his aim in science was to think the thoughts of God after him, so to work out, well, what was God thinking? Why didn't he design things like he did? And so that's where all our science came from. So is evolutionary science real science? Because, remember, it's observations and repeated testing and all that sort of stuff. That's what science is. That's how we get anywhere. That's how we get medical breakthroughs and things like that. But evolutionary science doesn't work like that because it's historical. We're studying things that have happened in the past, and they're not observable because they've already happened. They're not repeatable, and they can't be tested. So you're relying on interpretation of data of what you might still have in the present to try and look at or guess at what's happened in the past, come up with some scenario that might explain what has led to what is now happening. So, you can't go back and have another look at the Big Bang. You can't go back and have a look at, in slow motion, watch how the galaxies have formed or how life somehow came about, and watching how one type of organism becomes more and more complex and becomes other things. You can't see those things. They've all happened, and it's all happened in the past, apparently. So you can't see them, you can't test them. So, we can only look at things that we have today and make an interpretation of that about what may have happened in the past. So, for example, we can discuss through a few of the issues where there's truth, matters. And one of the maybe most important things is the age of the Earth. This is just the title of another talk that I give that just looks at the age of the Earth. And Andrew mentioned the issue of faith, and I have another talk which looks at the enormous faith that you need to believe that evolution exists and works in the way that we're told, because there are so many issues where you need enormous leaps of blind faith, which, again, I haven't got time to go through all, but it's important that you understand it's not a question of science versus faith. This is science versus science and faith versus faith. It's actually a level playing field, and the evidence is very strong on our side, let me tell you. But this age of the Earth is maybe where the contrast between the two stories is at its greatest, the stark contrast between a biblical view and a secular view, because, you're looking at, say, here's a biblical view where the world is, say, 6,000 or 7,000 years old, and the only alternative that we're given is that the universe is 14 billion years old. You would think, isn't that ludicrous, that we have two choices, 7,000, 6,000, 7,000 years and 14 billion. There's nothing in between. It's not like we're arguing between 5 million and 6 million. It's just this huge gulf. So anyway, up until the time of Darwin, most people accept the biblical timeline as presented here as correct. There was no compelling reason. No one had any particular reason to doubt that this was true. This is actually the dates according to the Bishop Usher, who wrote a famous history of the world at the time, and he placed creation at 4004 BC based on his study of the Old Testament and all the hints and clues and information and numbers that are given, through the genealogies and all the other historical. There's a lot of detail in the Old Testament, lots of numbers and years and things. You add them all up, you can't be exact because there are some blurry areas of a few years here and a few years there, but it's not more than a few hundred years at the most where there's issues about exactly the number. But his number was 4004 BC, which puts us obviously at about 6,000 years now. Now, Jesus himself claimed discusses, he says here, and Paul also describes Genesis as history, talks about it as, well, that when that happened, he doesn't talk about, and in the story of, he says, talks about it as history. At the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. So there's the timeline. You've got 4,000 years before Christ, and so in the beginning, there's Adam and Eve. At the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Now, according to evolutionary timescales, you've got a slightly different picture, because you know, we've got 13 billion years of the Big Bang, and then there's Adam and Eve, whatever, whoever they were at that end, before, you know, at the beginning of, you know, recorded history, if you like. So clearly that's not the beginning of creation, because we're a long way down the track. So the problem appears to be that Jesus was just unaware of history and needed a bit more education. So as I say, he saw Jesus very much as history. And now, the issue of the age of the earth, as I said at the very beginning, is about respecting the authority of God's word. And I think this is probably the most important issue, even more important than the creation-evolution argument, because if the earth is young, as the Bible suggests, then evolution is irrelevant, because it can't have happened in the very brief time that the Bible describes. So let's have a little look at this. Darwin, you know, had his ideas about evolution, and that came about only as a result of the books he was reading about geology, and this guy in particular, Charles Lyell, who wrote this famous book, Principles of Geology, that affected geology for over 100 years. It was the most important book. And these guys developed this idea called uniformitarianism, which I'm not going to spend too much time on, but it basically said that everything in the world happens slowly and over a long period of time. Everything. And so that was, and that allowed the amount of time that Darwin potentially needed for his ideas to work. So when we look at, let's just look at you know, the scientific discovery or the experiments that Hutton and Lyell did to begin this idea of the age of the earth. And what was the discovery, what was the results that led them to this conclusion? Well, here it is. Hutton went to visit this place in Scotland, and he looked at the rocks, and he said, I think this is really old. And that's it. It was an idea, it was a thought bubble. That looks really old, because those layers are, look, I think that's just happened over a long period of time, and then they just took that idea and ran with it. There was absolutely no science involved in the initial thing. There was no discovery that led them to this. It was purely a philosophical idea. And the whole idea is that it wasn't just about science. In fact, it wasn't that much to do with science at all. It was more to do with rebellion against the prevailing thoughts of the day, was that the Bible pretty much controlled all aspects of life, as it should have. And that included science. As I said, all those scientists were basing their ideas on their biblical knowledge. But Lyell and Hutton and people like him didn't like that, and they wanted to get away from that. So what they then did was, Lyell said straight out, says, my aim is to free science from Moses. In other words, to get it away from the Bible. They wanted another way of seeing the world that didn't just keep bringing them always back to their creator God. Because if you can do that in science, then maybe you can do that in other parts of life. And ultimately people, this is the aim, ultimately people could live their life without having to be accountable to a creator God. And this is basically the fundamental reason that we have this whole alternative story at all. Because we need a world without God in order to live the lives that we want without, you know, and be masters of our own destiny. That's what this is really all about. It's a philosophical argument. So that's what's actually happened now. Through that initial thing and then evolution, we now have a situation where, I'll just quote from Michael Denton, he says, the influence of evolutionary theory on fields far removed from biology is one of the most spectacular examples in history of how a highly speculative idea for which there is no really hard evidence, scientific evidence, can come to fashion the thinking of a whole society and dominate the outlook of an age. So the ideas that have started from the geology and the evolution have now spread to all aspects of society, that we can live in a world unencumbered by the problems of being accountable to a creator God, because we have a better story, a better as in gives us the kind of result we want. Those of you who are familiar with George Orwell or have read 1984 would understand how this works. In the novel, he says, who controls the past controls the future, and who controls the present controls the past. So now in the present, we have a strong movement to rewrite our history such that our whole history has changed from being a biblical one to a godless one. And in doing so, if you get people then to believe that, that new history changes completely how we see ourselves and how we see the world today, and therefore obviously has a massive effect on the future. This is how it works. This is the philosophy of it. So you know, a world which has come around gradually and randomly by purely random processes over billions of years is a very different world to live in than one that was intentionally and purposefully created by a God, a loving God, less than 10,000 years ago. And so we are now living in times of universal deceit. It would be the summary of what I'm telling you. And so telling the truth, which is what I'm encouraging you to have faith in, that the Bible gives us the truth, it becomes a revolutionary act. I think in our case it's more a counter-revolutionary act, and it's time to begin the revolution or to keep it going. So let's look at other areas where truth matters. What about the flood? Well, the flood never happened. I mean, that's nonsense. That's what we're told. But if the earth isn't billions of years old, if it is more, the biblical timescale is true, then the flood of Noah, as described in the Bible, is the only explanation that we have for the geology and the geography of the world as we see it. But, people say, well, if there was a massive flood that covered the world, we'd have evidence, surely. I can't see any evidence. I just can't see it. I'm looking around, but I just don't see any evidence. Well, if you had a flood, what would you expect to see? You'd expect to see massive layers of rock, thick and massive, laid down by water all over the earth and filled with buried dead things. And in fact, that's exactly what we have. The earth is covered by vast areas of sedimentary rock, sometimes kilometres thick, all laid under running water and full of dead things that have been buried rapidly. So that's exactly what you would expect to see. Well, that's good. But, those people, they didn't know what was going on in the whole world. It was just a local flood. It was just that the Bible describes it as a local flood that covered all the high mountains, which does create some logistical problems. And if it was a local flood and Noah spent 100 years building the ark, why didn't he just walk away? It would have been a lot easier. And the birds could have just flown off. And there's a whole lot of reasons why a local flood just doesn't make sense. And the Bible does give specific details about the depth of the water and everything. Why would you bother if it's just a local flood? It just doesn't add up from a biblical point of view. But there isn't enough water. Where did it all go? You need a lot of water for a global flood. Well, the earth has got a fair bit of water. 70% of the globe is covered in it. And most of the water is actually under the crust. So what you see on the surface is only a small part of what actually exists. There's more of it underneath. And Genesis 7:11 says that the flood began when all the fountains of the great deep burst forth. So initially there was, the flood is much more than just 40 days of rain. It was a complete convulsion of the earth with complete change of the surface, and there was a whole catastrophe in every possible way. And so at the beginning it actually began with the water gushing forth from the earth, and then because of all the seismic activity, volcanoes were going off, and we have cloud, then all the rain came from the dense cloud cover that resulted. So we're reading the story from the perspective of the people seeing it. From a geophysical point of view, it was a massive event. Anyway, if you were able to theoretically flatten the earth out so that you raise the oceans and you drop the mountains and you just make it flat, just the water on the surface of the earth would cover us to 3 kilometres in depth. So there's a lot of water on the earth, plenty of water for a flood. But, there can't have been a flood on earth. But here's another planet where a global flood is quite acceptable. This is Mars, and this is a thing called the Valles Marineris. It's a big canyon, and that canyon is 5,000 kilometres long, it's 100 kilometres wide, and it's 7 kilometres deep. Makes the Grand Canyon look pretty scratchy. That is accepted universally as being caused by a global flood on Mars. Now, we know there's water on Mars, but it's hard to find. It's sort of tucked up in ice caps, and it's probably under the surface. But no problem here that a huge amount of water caused this. But hey, no, we don't have a flood on this planet because that's just not possible. So can you see the philosophy coming into all this? Because details and stories I could tell you about scientific evidences that tell us that the biblical account is a much better explanation for the world we see around us than the ideas of evolution. Just a couple of other ones before we just wrap up. Polystrate fossil tree trunks. That's a tree trunk that's fossilized. So it's been turned to stone and it's lying there going through these different layers of rock that go this way. Now, we're told that these layers all take millions of years to form, and then there's a gap here, which probably was several million years, and then, again, a slow process. So what's this tree trunk doing just sitting there? Was it just standing there for millions of years, waiting to be buried slowly under all this? And it doesn't make sense. Coal miners see this all the time in coal seams, that these trunks, often upside down, just lying through several layers of coal, which is supposedly millions of years to form. It doesn't actually add up on a secular view. Here's a picture of a carving in Cambodia at Angkor Wat. And who here, you have to be under 12, who's going to tell me what that is? Yeah, stegosaur. Why do you say it's a stegosaur? Because it looks like a stegosaur, right? It doesn't look like anything else, does it? Does it look like a cow with some decorations put on its back? Because that's what we're told this is. Can't be a stegosaur. Why can't it be a stegosaur? Because it was carved 800 years ago. So how could you know what a stegosaur looked like 800 years ago? Because no one was there to tell them that these were extinct. So this is not just the only example. Around the world, there's several examples all over the place of drawings and carvings of obviously dinosaur-like creatures, let's just call them dinosaurs, that people saw and carved. Because this is in a column of commonly seen things like cats and dogs and snakes and, a stegosaur, might just chuck one of those in. Well, if you accidentally drop a dinosaur bone, which you try not to do because they're, precious, but if you do, then, it's broken now, let's have a look inside this T-Rex bone, what will we see? Well, this scientist found red blood cells under the microscope, still sitting there. Not only that, but also found soft tissue sort of in the bone, which was still stretchy, and you could pull it and then it would snap back into place. And that stuff, so the question the scientists asked, because they were well trained, was they didn't ask the question, well, I wonder how old this really is. Their question was, how does this stuff last 65 million years? Because they've been so well trained in the philosophy. DNA and all the other complex organic molecules that must have been kind of making themselves and just lying around on Earth waiting for life to happen, how does that occur? These things are incredibly complex, cannot handle. They just don't appear randomly, and they can't just lie around waiting because they're incredibly fragile. They can only exist inside a living cell. If you haven't got living cells, where are they going to hide? There's no explanation. Worse still, inside every living cell, of which you each have a trillion of, each one has complex genetic information, masses of it, and information is not something that comes about randomly. No scientist would tell you that complex information appears randomly. So where did it all come from? And how did it keep increasing through evolution, which I haven't got time to explain to you, but evolution is supposed to work through a combination of natural selection and genetic mutation, and both of those processes only result in a loss of information. You don't get a gain. So we don't know where all that information came from. Irreducible complexity is a problem that Darwin mentioned in his book. There's a number of things that Darwin mentioned in his book that we don't get told about. One of them was, the problem I have is the fossil record doesn't show the intermediates, like, if I have one kind of animal turning into another kind of animal, there should be lots of examples in the fossil record of the ones in between. But there aren't any. But he said, don't worry, we've only just started. We'll find them all. Well, 150 years later, we haven't found any. There should be more of them than there are of the things that we recognize. This is the other thing he said. He said in his book, he said, if you could be shown any example, one example of something in nature that could not come about by gradual step-by-step processes, then his theories can be falsified. Now, this is a mousetrap. It's not a natural thing, but let's just use it as an example. There's, say, five pieces in that. There's a base and a spring and a couple of other bits. If you have them all separated and lying on a table, it's not a mousetrap. It only works as a mousetrap, and all of them put together in the right order, in the right way. And until then, if you have all the pieces except one, it's still not a mousetrap. It's only a mousetrap, and all of them are there. So how does it get from all the bits separate to all the bits coming together? How does it survive, if it were a living thing, how does it survive in between when it's not working until it gets to the end? This is called irreducible complexity. Now, Darwin said if he could be shown any single example in nature, then the problem with this, unfortunately, that is that we've come, it's countless. You just can't end the list of irreducibly complex things in nature that cannot work, with mutation. design out there. Whatever you see, remember there is no design out there at all. It cannot be. I'm not going to go into radiometric dating, which is a big subject, but very, very important. Carbon-14 dating is a form of radiometric dating. I can't explain the technical details. I'm sorry if this is over the head for anybody, but carbon-14 is something that's used to age, to attempt to interpret an age for things that have that were once living. So coal has come from living things that have been crushed and heated and turned into coal, apparently over millions of years. Now, carbon-14 is a radioactive part of carbon, and it disappears in something once it's dead and has been turned into something else like coal. You start losing carbon-14 such that after 50,000 to 100,000 years, all of it is gone. It gradually degrades. Now, coal shouldn't have any carbon-14, but when Christian scientists had it tested, every sample of coal that was tested had lots of carbon-14 in it. But that was obviously a problem with the coal. It must have been contaminated, because that can't happen. So, well, let's do it with diamonds. So they did the same thing with diamonds, which are made of carbon. And diamonds take millions of years to make, billions of years sometimes, we're told. But every specimen of diamond that was tested in the labs all came up with carbon-14 in significant amounts. So where does that all come from? That says that they can't be as old as we're told they are. It just cannot be. Now, interestingly, diamonds, you know, we're told that they take such a long time to make. But if you go to, in America, there's a creepy kind of company that makes diamonds out of the remains of your loved ones. If you have a dear grandmother that passes away and she has a cremation, you can send her ashes to these guys and they'll turn it into a diamond, because it's made of carbon, right? It takes them a few months. It doesn't take millions of years. You can wear your grandma on your ring. Creepy, but true. It just serves to show that a lot of the things we're told take forever just don't take very long. There's a guy in South Australia that makes opals in a Vegemite jar over a number of weeks, and an expert can't tell the difference between them and the real thing that they dig out of the ground. It's all about process and the environment, the environment being right at the time. So, you know, a lot of things happened during the flood, which just accelerated so many geological processes such that, you know, things that we assumed were very old were all produced very, very quickly in the right circumstance. And here's another one, so carbon-14, which, as I said, should have disappeared in any specimen after 50 to 100,000 years. Well, someone, again, not these weren't biblical scientists, Christians, though, but for some reason they tested carbon-14 in dinosaur bones, and we know that they died out 65 million years ago, so what's the point? But anyway, they did it, and to their shock, found lots of carbon-14 in all their specimens. So they went to their big conference in Singapore and told all their fellow scientists, look what we found, carbon-14. Wow, isn't that amazing? Everyone's shaking their heads going, that's really weird. I'm doing my head in. Anyway, at the end of the conference, you get a published booklet with abstracts from all the different presentations. And strangely, theirs wasn't in there. And they went to the organizer and said, well, hang on, we were here, you know, where's our abstract? And said, well, I'm sorry, but we found that we could not accept your findings, so we just can't publish you, I'm sorry. That's just too bad, I guess. I was going to talk to you about exploding stars, but just let me tell you that supernova is an exploding star. If the universe is billions of years old, there should be heaps of these in the sky, like lots and lots and lots. If the biblical story is true, there should only be a few. And I can tell you that if you look at the sky, it's an easy test to do, you'll find that there are no supernovae of beyond a certain young age, and there should be thousands of them if the universe is as old as we're told. I haven't got time to go through the details of that any more than that, because we need to just get to the end. And the end is basically when, you know, my job here is not to give you answers to everything. In fact, I've intentionally avoided giving you a lot of answers, because I just want you to have questions. I want you to have a desire to answer those questions for yourselves, because it's no good me giving you all the answers. Because the point of our ministry is not to be showing off about how much I know or pretend to know. The point of our ministry is to, I guess, move you along one step. You know, if you have never come across this idea that the Bible might be history, well, this might challenge you to have a think about that. If you, you know the Bible, but don't really think that first part of the Bible, even though it's written as historical narrative and all the grammar and the syntax means it's just a statement of fact, it's not a story, it's not an allegory, it's not poetry or anything like that, if it's still, that's not, you know, doesn't sit right with you, and you want to sort of try and put the evolutionary ideas in and combine that with the rest of the biblical view, that's fine. Maybe this will challenge you to have a think about that and look at it again. If you're already like saying, yeah, I know, well, this is good, I believe you, little step along that road. And to do that, well, what we need to do. Benjamin Franklin was a great guy, very intelligent. He was said to be the last person that knew everything. Now, of course, we all know everything now because we've got Google and Wikipedia. But he didn't have those, so he just learnt it all. But he knew the limits of his own mind. He said, "Till me and I forget," which means, you know, science and repeated testing and observation has shown that a talk like mine, you'll have forgotten everything I said by next Sunday. And Andrew will have something much more interesting to tell you about it anyway. By the way, AGMs, I've been to plenty of Baptist AGMs. And if anyone can make it fun, it would be Andrew. But do come, because it does make life so much easier for Andrew and the leadership to have people come along and you know, support what you're trying to do. So AGMs can be fun. You can do it. So, you'll have forgotten everything by next Sunday. That's just science. Repeatable, testable science. Teach me and I may remember. So if I come back next Sunday and say, "Andrew, out of the way, I'm giving another talk." Then, if I kept doing that, you would learn more. But you still wouldn't look, you know, it still wouldn't be that, it wouldn't really make much of a difference to you. Involve me and I learn. So the only way this is going to matter is if you get involved. If this becomes something important to you. And so, that's what we want you to do. We want you to get involved. We want you to become equipped and empowered. And the way to do that, from our point of view as a ministry, the thing that has, you know, in 40-odd years that this has been going on, the thing that makes a difference in people's lives is to take something home with you and get involved to start learning. Now, we've given you something to take home, which is great. So that's a start. You've got Infobytes that I mentioned before. That's free and it's available on your computers. Go for it. We've got the website, all of that. So any of those things are a great start. That's, as I said, over the decades, that's the only thing that's made any difference.